Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Hume, editor of the Investors Chronicle. It's been a tumultuous week again, which is great for us in the business of news. I'm joined today by Bradley Gerrard, news editor. How are you doing, Bradley?
I'm great, thanks, John.
Wonderful. Ian Smith, companies editor. How are you, Ian?
Nicely bad, John. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Good. And Emma Powell, our banking correspondent. How are you, Emma?
Good, thanks.
Good. And you've written the cover feature.
I have.
Banks after Brexit.
Yeah.
It's been a bit of a difficult time for them recently.
Yes.
Or should I say, because I had a wonderful tweet this week from a reader. So I would say the banks have been having a torrid time of late. Now, I didn't realise I did this, and maybe you can correct me, but I had a reader tweet me to suggest the podcast drinking game. Which is one shot every time I say a torrid time, which in the markets we've been having recently is quite a lot. Now, I didn't realise I said a torrid time a lot. Do you think I say a torrid time a lot?
I'm not sure how often you say a torrid time, but I have noticed are no drinks around us.
Because our reader, Colin Lusk, on the other end, he's playing the drinking game. Every time I say a torrid time...
He's probably having
a torrid time. Sure, he must be. Well, by now, he's had about five shots, so he will soon be having a torrid time.
Absolutely.
Given the markets we've been having, which has been fairly torrid, I mean... It's been a torrid time. It's hardly surprising that I've said a torrid time quite a lot. So, you know, poor Colin Lusk, I think by the end of this, is going to be Colin Lush because it's been a torrid time. And the bank's been having a torrid time. Torrid time for all.
That's enough.
Thank you for the tweet, Colin. It's fantastic. And I will do my very best not to say a torrid time so much in the future. I will find an alternative for the phrase a torrid time.
I haven't noticed that you use that, a wonderful alliteration, but yeah.
Yes. Well, I won't say it again. Okay, right. Busy week again. All change in government, which we've been excitedly following all morning. But we're not necessarily interested in politics for the sake of politics, interesting though it may be. Bradley, what's going on in the news?
Well, I mean, I guess a brief point on the whole Brexit situation. I mean, one very key thing about it is that we're told by the Leave camp that we were going to be very much open for business and seeking trade deals left, right and centre with the most exciting economies around the world. Well, the EU's trading goods deficit with China hit a record 180 billion euros, and actually the UK had one of the biggest deficits. So if we are going to start trading with the wider world outside of Europe, we're going to need to get our skates on because this data isn't that great.
Yeah, but a deficit is, you know, let's suggest that we are buying goods from them. They will want to continue trading with us.
That's true. So it's not entirely bad, but also we do want to balance it a bit as well. You know, you want exports to... You perhaps don't want such a big deficit. The UK needs to maybe balance that a bit.
But then we are naturally an importing type of country. And I guess this was one of the key planks of the Leave campaign. People will want to continue selling to us. Therefore, we will be able to go and strike trade deals.
Quite possibly. And actually, I suppose the counterbalance to that is that actually our export in services was the third highest in the EU behind Germany and Ireland.
Now, that is a worry that I think many in the Remain camp said that the Leave camp had underestimated. And I guess a lot of those services would revolve around financial services.
Yeah, absolutely.
So probably the most important person in terms of the cabinet reshuffle that we've seen is David Davis, who's the new Minister for Brexit.
Minister for Brexit.
And he's been writing on the Conservative Home website about what he had written recently about the kind of trade deals that he would go after. And I think everyone's looking for, are we going to go down this kind of Norway type model with access to the European Economic Area, or are we going to kind of be forced to trade according to world trade rules and seek, you know, these individual agreements for different countries? So everyone's watching kind of very closely what he's saying and how he's directing things.
I guess another key plank of the Leave campaign was that Europe doesn't actually have trade deals with many of the countries we're talking about anyways. It doesn't have a trade deal yet with the United States. It's been trying to strike this TTIP for many, many years. It doesn't have a trade deal with China. doesn't have a trade deal with India, as far as I'm aware.
And that's why we have another minister, new ministerial position as well, which is drumming up international trade deals, which is Liam Fox. So that would be, you know, I think those two positions together will be absolutely key.
Indeed.
To our leadership.
Indeed. And also, I mean, you know, given that trade is something that's conducted across borders, we've also got Boris at the Foreign Office.
Well, yeah.
Wow.
We've got a foreign minister who's not going to be responsible for Brexit or for international trade deals. So I'm not sure who's going to want to meet him when he goes overseas.
Oh, come on, everyone wants to meet Boris, don't they?
Do they? Yeah,
they do.
We have a sweepstake in the office about how long he's going
to
last.
Oh, really?
But I won't say who's on which type of that. Well, yeah. You were too busy organising your drinking games.
Yeah, sorry about that. You know, well...
You were having toy time.
Maybe Boris will join me in the future for some of them. Okay, right, so trade, obviously Brexit... Yeah, repercussions big in the news. The thing that struck me that I thought was quite interesting was this pension deficit issue that's raised its head this week.
Yeah, it's quite big. It's data out from the Pension Protection Fund, I think it was, and it basically shows that the sort of state of UK PLCs, so the pension deficit, is really quite terrible. So the UK's aggregate pension deficit has reached 383.6 billion. So it kind of means that a total of 84% of pension funds are in deficit, which obviously is not a great situation to be in.
Ian, this was your old patch from
my
the previous title. So, I mean, from zero in 08 to 380 billion today, that's a significant move. But what are your thoughts on this?
It's obviously the lower interest rate for longer environment that we've seen, and what that means is that gilt yields have kind of been pushed down, as we all know, which means that pension funds liability, so these are the kind of older type of pension funds where they have promised a kind of certain level of pension, so the liabilities under those pension schemes are much higher, and there's a big gap between the assets and the liabilities, so that's the deficit, and those deficits are going to be wider and wider for longer. Why does that matter? Well, companies' contributions into these schemes are based on this funding calculation, so if it stays the way that it has been, it may mean that companies are having to pay more into their pension schemes, or they're having to extend the recovery plans of payments into their pension schemes. It's not good news for companies.
No, I guess that reflects what you said in your chart yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, interestingly, when I also used to write about pensions, I remember covering some pension schemes, and actually the fact that so many pension schemes are in deficit, I mean, it was very rare that you would come across a defined benefit pension scheme that was fully funded, like incredibly rare, really. I remember reporting on some pension schemes, and as Ian said, usually they use gilts to discount the liabilities. And actually, I came across a few that started using alternative methods because gilt yields were so low.
Mm.
So things like total return from the pension scheme assets and things like that. And when they did their triennial valuations. So there's different ways of doing it, but it is a worrying trend because you could do, obviously, increase your employer contributions, or if employers don't have, you know, this cash to use to plug the scheme deficit. I know there's companies like Diageo, for instance, that use kind of alternative ways of financing. I think it was whiskey Diageo did. Cheese has also been used.
Cheese?
I can't, who was that did the cheese?
Dairy Crest?
Yeah.
And so it would have been Dairy Crest, surely.
Who was the cheese? Yeah, I think
I don't know, but they're the two famous examples.
They basically use these contingent assets to kind of back the pension scheme. So it's fascinating. Companies are trying to get around this issue, but there's also obviously impacts on dividends.
I was going to say, if a company doesn't have any cheese or whiskey to plug its pension shortfall, then the cash has got to come from somewhere, and dividends seems the most obvious solution.
And we wrote a feature about this earlier this year, and at many companies, the company actually has to agree with the trustee that the pension scheme, what it will do to service the deficit ahead of being able to promise any dividends to shareholders. So it really can be a kind of a covert threat to your returns. And at the moment, pension schemes really are having a torrid time.
Yeah, indeed. And there was a very good comment, actually, from Andrew at smithepping.com on your piece, which is worth a read. Yeah, we get some good comments on the website, and this is one of them. But I guess this guy's worry is that low interest rates actually lead to a misallocation of capital into things like housing and real estate. And, you know, I guess something we're seeing with the property bubble as it stands at the moment.
Yeah, because the returns that pension funds get on their fixed income assets is so low, they turn to alternatives such as infrastructure or kind of areas of property, which then, you know, means a lot of institutional money and insurance company money as well, alongside pension funds, is kind of pouring into those areas to try and eke out greater return, which obviously when you have that kind of capital flow can distort valuations in those areas. So, you know, there's a wider impact that this can have, which ultimately can hit retail shareholders too.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, property's obviously been in the spotlight recently, particularly some of the issues that have come to the fore regarding the structure of some of the open-ended vehicles that have had to essentially gate this week to redemptions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as you say, there was quite a few, mainly last week, open-ended funds having to prevent investors buying or selling units in those funds, because to try and sell a building very quickly is obviously very difficult. And so what was happening is that as the kind of fear around Brexit was ramping up, you saw people wanting their money back from property funds. And although most funds run by the likes of Standard Life Investments, Aviva Investors, while they have a cash buffer, they were seeing that kind of eroded quite a lot. And actually, it seems that the Bank of England and the Financial Conduct Authority kind of were talking about this potential risk on the day of the outcome of the Brexit vote. And there seems to be a sort of consensus among policymakers that there may well need to be something done about the structure of open-ended property funds, because we've seen this a couple of times now.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, we kind of knew this was a risk all along, and the FCA apparently knew this was a risk all along. And in fact, they had been looking at particularly property-based open-ended funds to work out how they could mitigate some of this risk, and yet it's happened again.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a risk since it happened last time.
Indeed.
At least since then.
I mean, I look at this piece and they say, we're going to look again at how the funds work. Well, come on, we kind of knew anyway. But it's madness.
I guess what they're trying to do is they have to be quite careful, I suppose, in terms of how they are seen to intervene in the market, although they obviously are a regulator, so they kind of can do. So I guess what they're really saying is that, look, asset managers out there, can you please come to us with a situation that we can say, yeah, that's the way forward, or at least do it collegiately rather than forcing through a change, which the FCA probably doesn't want to do unless it really, really has to.
One of the things that has appeared to come up this week is that some of these property funds are investing in other property funds or real estate investment trusts or whatever, just other types of property. So what you have is essentially a really kind of bizarre circular ownership, so that when something starts to go, everything goes. That's terrifying. We should not be here. This has happened before, and this should not be allowed to be happening.
I guess so. The ownership of things like real estate investment trusts in an open-ended fund makes sense for that cash buffer. So if you're running an open-ended fund and you want not to just have cash, which doesn't really do much for you, but you want something that actually produces a bit of a return for investors, you buy a real estate investment trust. Then when you have a knock at the door from investors for your cash back, you can sell that investment trust straight away.
But then you've
redeemed some cash.
But then you have essentially magnified the contagion effect across an entire sector that happens when you do have these periods of stress, and then the whole sector starts to sell off.
Absolutely.
And everyone panics, and everyone starts to want to redeem their cash even more. I mean, this is just an accident waiting to happen.
And they also, I suppose, you also have the multi-asset funds and other funds as part of the same investment house that have invested in the property fund as well. So there's a kind of contagion there within the kind of manager.
And also the fact that model portfolios are becoming a very big thing nowadays, and they will probably rebalance quarterly, maybe more often, maybe less often. But I was put a lot of money on it that the vast majority, if not all, model portfolios will have some exposure to property. And they're likely to have done so through very credible and good funds like the ones we've seen that have had to gate investors' money.
I'm not saying they're not credible. I'm just saying that the whole industry seems to have proceeded in a way which is just basically is risky.
Yeah, I mean, it's been involved in a very sort of bullish situation. It's arguably got a bit away from itself. And I mean, I guess what the property funds could, or what the houses running property funds could have done to mitigate this is, and they did
have more cash.
Well, there's a couple of, there's half more cash and there's changed the pricing, which admittedly they did do a bit before Brexit, but maybe they didn't do it early enough or buy it enough. Maybe what they needed to do was actually ramp the pricing up to buy it by quite a lot to really disincentivize people. Often fund houses don't want to do that because obviously then they're not going to get money into an asset class that's actually doing quite well and is popular. But there's perhaps an argument for that, and maybe we'll see something from the FCA around that type of thing. Maybe there'll be something around pricing in relation to a certain dynamic in the market or something. I mean, it could be exceptionally complicated to actually figure out how you fix this problem.
I mean, I must admit, and I don't know if I've mentioned this on this podcast before, but certainly something we've discussed in the office. You know, if you look at our top 100 funds, yeah, there are a fair few property funds within there, pretty much all of them, with the exception of one. Pure property direct investor rather than a kind of fund of property listed investments. They're all investment trusts. And, you know, apart from the contagion effect, they don't have the same structural problem.
Yeah, it's arguably a much safer way to invest in property if you're going to, because of the fact that you can liquidate those shares straight away and get your money back. Whereas in a stress situation like we saw very recently with an open-ended fund, you know, the houses have the option of holding you in. I mean, one thing that's interesting actually that did happen this week is Aberdeen Asset Management. They took a slightly different approach. They did kind of... They greatly changed the valuation of the properties they were holding. So their NAV dropped by about, I think it's 17%. So that kind of disincentivizes selling. It's kind of meant to stabilize the market. They did put a suspension on trading and then they ended up extending it. And they said to people, if you've put in a sell order and you want to change your mind, then we're going to use this sort of 3 or 4 day period to let you do that. And they updated on this earlier this week. And a lot of people actually, according to them, did decide not to follow through with that sell thing. So arguably Aberdeen's approach and L&G did a fairly similar thing, okay, was a bit more sensible.
Yeah, lessons to learn then. I mean, talking of contagion, we have a chart about Italian banks this week and the drag down effect there on European financials as a whole. It's been terrifying.
Yeah, it has been terrifying, and it's not about to get much better potentially. There were some slightly reassuring words from Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor, earlier this week, saying effectively she didn't want to sort of obviously watch an Italian banking crisis happen. But effectively, the problem with Europe's banks is that they have a lot of bad loans, such as was the case with our own banks a few years ago. And the banks have written the value of these down quite a bit, but the market is even more sceptical on the valuations of these. So the share prices in Italian banks have been they've been hit very badly.
Well, the problem, I guess, with Italian banks is that a lot of the bonds in these banks are held by retail investors. That's so Italian banks don't want essentially the general public taking a massive hit. So they want to somehow recapitalise the banks to avoid this situation, but unfortunately European rules prevent them from doing so.
Yeah, exactly. So you've got the European rules preventing them, and you've got the fact that your base of investors is like the percentage of that is an ordinary man and woman on the street is quite high. So to ask them to chip in to save the bank is probably impossible, or at least not going to go down very well. So there's a bit of a problem there, but I suspect some loophole in European law may well be found.
Well, I guess they have to find one, otherwise you might see the next exit coming from Southern Europe.
Possibly. I mean, it's certainly a problem. Even if it doesn't precipitate another exit, it's going to precipitate another bout of fear.
Yeah, yeah. So, and we're going to touch on banks very shortly, Emma, when we discuss your excellent feature this week. Let's go to some of the longer news pieces we did. Burberry is interesting. Never been a fan myself, but they have a new chief exec. And shares responded well.
Yeah, they did. The share price kind of ignored the fact that actually performance was pretty flat. But the interesting thing about Burberry is that Christopher Bailey has acted as the group's joint chief executive and creative head. Maybe that doesn't sound too strange to listeners, but actually those two roles are very, very often split within fashion houses because they're arguably very different skills, making sure you're creating a product that people want and actually running a business. They're two different skill sets.
Yeah, well, Christopher Bailey has been the creative force behind Burberry for a long time. So during Angela Arend's tenure as chief executive.
Exactly.
And it was seen as quite unusual when he took over as chief executive and retained that job.
Yeah.
I guess they were scared to let him give up the creative side of things, given how well he had done in that respect, but wanted to reward him and not, you know, essentially not jump over him for the job that he probably had earned in respect of the work he'd done. It's a tricky situation for them.
It obviously was, but obviously the outcome of that tricky situation was that it hasn't gone incredibly well. I mean, from a sort of shareholder perspective, I guess, an operational performance perspective, that can be down to things that are perhaps outside his control. I mean, just sort of sentiment in the market, demand for luxury goods.
Well, especially with China, and it's clamped down on essentially corporate gift giving and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so there are things you can't control, but it seems that obviously what's happened now is that we're going to have a return to two people doing these two distinct roles.
It's important to have a chief executive that will talk regularly to the market and be present for that. And shareholders, obviously, for good reason, don't like it when they don't have direct access to that person. My feeling with this, I wonder how it seems like, this perfect solution now that he's stepped aside. But the history doesn't have great precedence for people that kind of step down, or whether it's a step aside or whether it's a step down from the top job. Whether he was, is he going to be very well incentivized to stay within the business? Is that, a big step down? For me, I think it adds a little bit of unpredictability, while it obviously is a good thing for the business in the short term. You wonder what's next for Mr. Bailey.
Mm, indeed. Well, David Cameron hasn't stepped down from PM into the cabinet, has he? I mean, it's not the way it works.
Yeah.
I guess there's parallels there.
And for example, if we look at Alliance Trust, which is the kind of comparison after the big shareholder revolt against the head there, Catherine Garrett Cox.
Yep, that's right.
She stepped back from the kind of the leadership role to the kind of former role that she had, and she left shortly thereafter. So it's not always great news that someone will kind of step back, but this does seem quite logical.
I guess as well, they've hired somebody who is likely potentially to know Christopher Bailey very well, having been in the fashion industry himself, as Marco Gobetti, who is joining from French luxury house Celine. So
I know it well.
Exactly, yeah. So do I, all my Celine bags and clothes. So, I mean, there's a chance at least that the hire is a sensible one for Burberry itself, in terms of they've hired a well-known fashion name. But also there's a chance that, obviously, because he understands the fashion business, he'll be very well aware of Christopher Bailey as a designer, and obviously, as you said, John, the skills that he's brought to Burberry in terms of designing and keeping the company on trend, I suppose.
Indeed. And we still like Burberry shares, and from a historical perspective, they're very cheap, so we've got them on a buy still.
And a nice weak pound as well.
And a nice weak pound. I mean, talking to the weak pound, there's another story here that Harriet's written on pricing pressure for British retail. I guess that does stem largely from the fact that most of the goods that are sold in the shops here are sourced from overseas, often in dollars, so there is a concern that prices will need to rise.
Yeah, exactly. And you've got this coming on top of, obviously, the National Living Wage, which was implemented earlier this year, and there's something that different sizes of companies will deal with in sort of different ways. So you've had that pressure. You've now got this pressure, as you say. If a company's buying stock or goods from overseas, particularly the US, a bit from Europe, that's become more expensive in the past few weeks, given sterling's fall. Although there was a bit of a rally actually today in sterling because of the fact that interest rates were held.
I think it's been going on for a couple of days, the Theresa bounce. I think people liked the fact that we had, as a nation, as a Conservative Party, elected a new leader quite quickly, and one who it was generally felt would have a less of a hardline stance on negotiations with Europe. So there was a big bounce in sterling when it became clear that Theresa May was going to be the next PM.
Yes, and return of some political certainty after an incredible period of volatility.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, talking to the weak pound, I guess that makes UK assets quite attractive. So we now have Poundland, which has a formal offer from Steinhoff.
Yep.
And they're getting a bit more for their money now.
Yeah, exactly. And they'll be pleased to have done this deal, seeing as it's been third time lucky in terms of attempted takeovers. Just this year, I think, actually. They tried Home Retail earlier in the year, and then they went for Darty as well, which is more based in France, but does have a listing in London.
I guess, though, that companies like Poundland were, again, sourcing a lot of their goods from overseas, but forced to sell them at a pound. And I guess this applies to a lot of the discount retailers, even if they aren't selling everything at a pound. The weakness of sterling is a real problem for anyone who doesn't have that ability to raise prices.
Yeah, they can't pass it on. They're also struggling from footfall hasn't been good. The integration of 99p stores has been more costly than they had anticipated. So there's actually quite a lot of problems facing Poundland. And there wasn't a huge amount of detail around what Steinhoff Meinhof wants to do with Poundland. So I'm going to be very interested to see what their strategy is for the business. Obviously, it's just Steinhoff wants to grow its European price-led retail group, retail operations. But yeah, I'd like to see what they're going to do to try and heal this business, because it works as long as they keep adding stores, but you know, the like-for-likes don't look good.
Seen that before. Growing stores often leads to overexpansion. So, you know, at some point, the kind of wheels come off. I mean, talking to US Predators, I was interested in this story about the takeover of Odeon and UCI cinemas by US cinema chain AMC. I guess, again, taking advantage of the weak pound.
Yeah, and they actually called it like an opportunistic transaction as well. So, yeah, as you say, AMC is, I think it's Texas-based, actually, in the US. And, yeah, they just saw an opportunity to buy up the London-based Odeon and UCI cinemas. And I guess if we are going to have a bit of softening in sort of the economy, maybe a cinema investment's a relatively sensible one, because, you know, cinemas are something people like to do. It's a treat. It's perhaps something they're not likely to think of giving up cold turkey. They might sort of go a bit less, but
cold
still
turkey from the cinema.
Well, I couldn't think of a better phrase.
We like cinemas. I mean, you know, the UK listed play on the cinema industry is obviously Cineworld. We've been fans of that for a very long time, and kind of been proven right all along.
Because they have, you know, the film slate in the past few years has been very good, which helps, but also you're seeing the businesses develop a bit in terms of what they're offering to the cinema goer. I mean, Cineworld, as the example, you know, seeing a lot more concessions come in, so things like Starbucks, you're seeing a lot more of those in the cinema. So what you're actually kind of getting is this, rather than just literally turning up to watch your film and leaving again, you might actually go a bit earlier, spend some money, have a coffee. You know, there's more sweets and things to choose from, and just as time goes on, there's a bit more to add, and they're chipping away at the amount of money they're getting from you.
Yeah, my kids like the Baskin Robbins concessions at Cineworld.
There you go.
Have you heard
the bank every time?
Have you heard the theatre complaints around Game of Thrones actor who's acting at the moment in the West End? I think he's doing Dr. Faustus, and there's lots of people that watch
Kit
TV.
Kit Harington,
you like him, don't you, Emma?
I like him a lot. And, yeah.
And people have been going into the theatre and eating loudly, talking on their mobile phones, and acting very un-theatre-like, almost like cinema goers.
The youth of today.
Honestly, what's the world coming to?
It's outrageous.
We also have results from Pinewood, and actually, what's quite interesting with Sterling's fall is that it makes it more attractive for people to come and film here.
And they're doing very well anyway.
Yeah.
So they were having conducting a strategic review into what they would actually do with the business, but I guess that's on a kind of back burner there.
There was no detail in the results, so yeah, we have to wait and see. I think Rothschild's in there advising them about what to do, but yeah, they are running a high capacity on the film side, which is actually keeping their television stuff low, but you know, that's a good problem to have. And they're doing very well.
Okay, I mean, let's go back to the US takeover of Odeon as an example, Ian, because this kind of preludes your Taking Stock column this week, which is about activist investors. Now, activist investors are essentially investors who take large stakes in companies to get a seat on the board and then go and give it a shake up. And this is quite common in the US, but not so over here. But I think what you're saying is we might see a bit more of it.
Perhaps not what I'm saying. That's what people normally
say. Share price falls in a weaker currency could encourage overseas activists.
Could. This is very interesting. And this is one of the things, one of the suggestions made by Owen Walker, who's an FT journalist who wrote this book, Barbarians in the Boardroom. And he said this at the launch that Bradley and I went to a couple of weeks ago, which was that, yeah, as I've said, if the, you know, with the weaker pound and also with the share price falls, we're going to see stakes perhaps being taken by activist investors. We've already seen that this year with Rolls-Royce, which has been suffering for a while, that the US San Francisco-based firm ValueAct took a stake in Rolls-Royce and actually now has a seat on the board. My column is really about how UK activism and shareholder activism and European shareholder activism by extension is more quietist than the kind of US version. There's a couple of reasons for that that talks about in the book, such as the fact that you actually as a shareholder within UK businesses have more rights than you do in the States to kind of call meeting. Well, yeah, it depends. We can start that debate. But there's why is there a cultural difference? Well, partly there's a kind of doing stuff behind the scenes, so we see activity like the Rolls-Royce things. This is not quite as public. Activist firms have learned that when they come to the UK, that they might want to take more of a softly approach. But perhaps, yeah, we'll see more of this. At the same time, we haven't seen an uptick in it over the past few years, some of the statistics that are in there. So it hasn't taken off in the UK in the way that it has in the US since the financial crisis.
Yeah, we did write a feature on this a few years back, kind of predicting that we would see a wave of activism. And again, it's like you say, it's been very low key. I mean, it has been there, sort of bubbling away in the background. But
I mean, is it too far to go to say that around things and governance standards, UK companies have put in quite a lot of work there? So where there's, I'm not saying UK companies are run better than US companies, but there seems to be an awareness, and institutional investors have worked on this for a long time around improving governance, actively engaging with companies. And just because they're not actually hedge funds that are activists, they are still trying to have an engagement with the company directors. So yeah, I think there's a few reasons why in the UK it perhaps hasn't taken off in the same kind of way, but there is still, you know, that board seat at Rolls-Royce, it was pretty unprecedented. But yeah, in the US is where you've seen some of the really interesting kind of case studies around some of these firms have, you know, less than 1% of the stock of a company, and they are causing major changes at those companies.
Yeah, I guess, as you say, it's something that we do a little more discreetly in this country. I've been watching Billions. I don't know if you've seen that yet on Now TV. Yeah, it's not a form of capitalism that I recognise, but from having worked in the city. But nevertheless, maybe it is real in the US, and I just I'm just not used to seeing it. But yes, it's if it's true, they do things a little bit more brusquely than we do over here.
I think in the UK, you're going to start seeing it a bit more, like Ian said. In the fund management industry, I think there's a big trend towards kind of what they call ESG investing, so environmental, social and governance investing. So investing on the basis that the companies you're putting your clients' money into are responsible companies. And so I think maybe that is kind of a low-level form of activism, I suppose, whereby the industry more broadly may well begin to reward companies whose governance is better, whose environmental responsibilities are better. So, like Ian's saying, it's a bit more sort of a quiet, you know, less aggressive approach.
Do you think that's partly because of there has been perhaps a cozy relationship between the larger shareholders, which tend to be the funds and pension funds, and the boards of the UK's largest companies, who tend to do the rounds and be non-executives, and you know, it is a bit of a club.
It is
really
a club, and that's why those activists like Value Act, which focus on building up their relationships with institutional investors, have been able to enact major change through those relationships. I think the interesting thing for our audience as retail shareholders is whether they'll get drawn into the fight at any point. And I mentioned Alliance Trust before, and that was an interesting one where Elliott Advisors, or the kind of UK arm of that, actually was directly set up its own shareholder registrar to actually contact retail shareholders. There was a big battle over the retail base of that company about which way they would vote. So it'll be interesting whether our readers do get drawn into the fray as a kind of swing vote. But, you know, primarily it's still probably going to be institutions. But yeah, like you say, that cozy relationship, which we know happens between large shareholders, because there is that cozy relationship, that perhaps that's a reason why activists haven't made as much of the inroads, because there's very much that conversation there already.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, retail investors, we know they own significant chunks of some of these companies, but their voice are not often heard as one, partly because of the thing I moan about a lot, which is the nominee structure, which actually removes some of their rights from them. Yeah, I mean, you know, that in particular I find particularly egregious, and would like to see something done about it. And if the government does do something about that and actually introduces a true shareholder democracy, we may actually see a bit more activism from the retail side.
Especially if that's the direction of policy a little bit. I mean, Theresa May's first speech just before actually she was confirmed as leader of the Tory party and thus Prime Minister talked about improving governance at companies. And it's something that's kind of been on the centre ground of British politics for a few years, and it was discussed under the coalition government, which was putting employees on boards. But now it's also thinking about putting consumers on boards as well. So if that is more than just talk and there is a will to kind of shake up big business from Ms. May, maybe we're going to see, you know, a shake up of board governance. And what does that mean? You know, how will that change the way that companies are run if they're forced to have a consumer on the board? I could think of companies where that would definitely be a good thing.
Centrica, for an example.
Yeah, exactly.
Where I am a customer of. I would love to have. I've got some words to say to their board.
Yeah, and when we're...
you know, the rail companies. Got yep. something to say to them. Yep. Well, they've probably heard it all already. So, no, I think it's very interesting. I was very struck by those words from Theresa May. And a lot of people were. And some people were very terrified of this what they saw as anti-business rhetoric that can actually do harm to shareholder returns in the years ahead if, you know, workers' rights and consumer rights become so loud that actually it eats into the returns these companies are making.
Yeah, that's definitely the other side of the argument. I wonder, obviously, the coalition government has put some of these proposals out to consultation before. They haven't been followed through. You wonder whether this is putting up a balloon. You wonder whether it's symbolically saying, I'm going to appeal to the centre ground. She actually said, I'm going to try and be radical. You know, in some ways, it's just
fairly radical in her new cabinet.
Yeah, exactly. So in some ways, it's a right of centre politician who's appealing to the centre ground by saying, look, we care about, you know, bashing big business, at least in rhetoric. But we will have to wait and see whether these proposals will come through. They've also talked about the pay multiples, something we've written about as well, between CEO and average worker. And yeah, so it's these things, I can imagine some people are quite cynical about this because it just tends to come back around these topics. Mm. But if there is some traction here, what does that mean for companies in terms of them being forced more to think about consumers? Yeah.
We will no doubt explore it in full, in the fullness of time. We write a lot about pay. Our freelance contributor, Paul Jackson, writes a lot about this. He's from that side of things, and I think we do some good stuff there. So anyone wants any advice on pay, director's pay, give us a shout. Okay, well, let's talk about banks, Emma. The cover feature this week. Banks have not exactly been doing wonders for their shareholders recently, nor indeed, some would say, their customers. And they've been very hard hit as a result of the referendum. I'm not sure it is entirely the result of the referendum, but what you're essentially saying is that what it has done is bring some of the problems they have into focus. What are those problems?
Yeah, like you said, I mean, financials have been having a tough time of it, a torrid time.
Oh, here we go, another shot.
For a long time, I mean, arguably since the financial crisis, frankly.
But they were on a bit of a recovery footing, you would have thought.
Yeah, and you know, some... You know, massive restructurings have happened, as I kind of mentioned. You know, people like Lloyds, RBS, Barclays to an extent have really stripped back a lot of their operations to have a lot more of a retail focus, more of a UK focus. Then there's, of course, you know, HSBC, who've kept that more universal model, but particularly Lloyds, Barclays, RBS. There's selling off a lot of operations to try and reduce their risk-weighted assets and a lot of their costs on one side, and they've made good inroads into that, but they're still having a really hard time of trying to actually make money to generate income, and the main reason for that is low interest rates.
Yeah, and so I mean, after Brexit, after the referendum results, you know, there was some further pressure on bond yields, gilt yields, etc. And it's that squeeze that, as you say in the feature, makes life difficult for them to make money. That kind of underpins the way they make money.
Yeah, basically what it means, it squeezes their net interest margin. So what that means is that you know, deposits are counted as a liability for a bank. They borrow short term and lend long term. Mm-hmm. It basically means that as the and we've seen it in the US as well, as the yield curve flattens, that gap between the normally high interest rates which they charge for things like mortgages, long term loans, the gap between that and where the interest they pay out on, say, you know, current account, bank accounts on those deposits is just getting it's getting tighter. So it's coming harder for them to make money. So, you know, when you get banks like Lloyds, RBS, where this is their big focus, is on retail operations, the returns on equity will become lower. And that's the concern. Basically, yeah, you can cut costs, but while doing that, you also do need to be generating income.
Yeah.
And with low interest rates, that becomes harder.
So I guess this is why, and obviously alongside things like the Italian banking crisis, and it is a crisis that we're seeing at the moment, whilst you have seen property shares bounce back, despite some of the problems we've had with open-ended funds, house builders have bounced back, despite worries about the consumer economy, and even some retailers have started to bounce back quite strongly as well, the bank shares haven't really responded in the same way.
No, it was interesting actually, because Standard Chartered and HSBC, obviously HSBC has, I think, about 80% of its income comes from Asia. Their shares actually, I think they've gained since Brexit.
Well, that's quite interesting, because so HSBC, Standard Chartered, much more global in scope, do have some UK operations, yeah. but a lot more around the world, and particularly in the Far East. RBS Lawyers, like you say, Barclays to a certain extent, much more focused on the UK, as are the challenger banks, who have also been hammered.
Who are more exposed, some would say, to the, obviously, they've been posting phenomenal growth, but it's SME and buy-to-let lending, so they've had a bit of a double whammy.
But I guess, you know, if you would have looked at the banking industry, say, 2 years ago, when, for example, the emerging market crisis was in full flow, it was HSBC and Standard Chartered that were getting hammered. You know, the ones with these global operations, the universal banks, as you might call them, and everyone wanted to be exposed to the retail lenders. Now it's the retail lenders that are the trouble. And so, how on earth are you expected to make sense of where to put your money as a bank investor? Or do you just retrench from the whole thing?
Well, that's the question that Emma is answering in this feature. But I think on that point, it's quite interesting that the Bank of England's last stress test modelled an emerging market crisis. And obviously, the banks that came through that stress test strongest were Lloyds, and those that didn't have that emerging market focus was actually now what we're looking to have is possibly a recession next year, or possibly just slower growth than expected, characterised by a fall in property, which means, you know, rising bad loans. It also, you know, it's going to suppress the kind of commercial banking operations of these lenders. So the problems that we're now seeing is, yeah, having that domestic focus. So it was really interesting for Emma's piece that you kind of, it played into that question of what kind of bank do you want to be? Do you want to back the universal banking model? And universal not just meaning global, but also meaning having investment banking operations, yeah, to have that diversity of revenue? Or are you sticking with the kind of highly capitalised retail-focused banks like Lloyds, thinking, well, we are going to still need retail banks in 10, 15 years, and it has a huge share of the market? I'll back that. It's well capitalized. It started to pay dividends again. It's a very difficult, I think it's one of the most difficult questions to answer at the moment for a private investor.
It's almost an impossible question. But Emma,
it is an almost impossible question.
I suspect you may have an answer.
And we've kind of stuck with Lloyds. We did, it was a recovery tip of the year, I think, by Ian at the start of this year, actually. It did come good. I think that on our buy advice, I think a lot of the investment case was on whether it would pay out or whether it would increase its dividend, which it did do. So it did pay out on that. And it is, we've stuck with that buy advice, and it is our kind of our top pick because it is very well capitalised. They've already shown that, you know, that they can increase the dividend in tough economic times. And I think to completely retrench from the financials, I think, would be a bit hasty right now. I mean, it's still very early days. But in terms of what you've got to go on, I think the restructuring plan seems like it's going in the right direction. I mean, RBS actually was another buy tip we did have, and I took it off a buy at the time of the last results because they actually pushed out their dividend even further. And I guess, you know, traditionally the financials, the banks were income stocks, and obviously they've changed massively in the past couple of years to, you know, not necessarily being that. And obviously Barclays cut their dividend, but I think that's why I wanted to stick with Lloyds for those kind of reasons.
What do you make of the prospects of the challenger banks now then? I mean, we like them.
Yeah.
But is life going to get much more difficult for them now?
I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? They were posting such high returns on equity. They were growing their loan books phenomenally. They were free of the legacy issues, you know, around mis-selling of PPI and things like that, that, you know, really weighed down the mainstream lenders. But of course, when something like this happens, I mean, Shawbrook, Aldermore, One Savings Bank, all just absolutely tanked. I mean, Shawbrook, actually, they had some issues around writing bad loans for their asset finance division. Mm-hmm. So maybe
specific companies different.
Company specific.
But it is in some ways symptomatic of an industry, asset finance, growing incredibly quickly. More competition coming into the sector, and then surprise, you have a lender that is writing loans that does not fit its risk criteria.
Yeah.
Which says to me, you know, it's going to happen inevitably. So you need to also look at the lenders that perhaps have a longer term track record around writing through cycles, Close Brothers perhaps being one of them. But yeah, I think one of the big questions for this is what is going to happen in the residential property market? If you, the predictions are currently from the sector that fewer houses are going to be coming onto the market. We saw
some stats today saying just that.
Exactly that. And we already saw running into this, all these kind of problems that banks are having, that there is greater competition for residential mortgages, which were putting further interest on those margins that Emma was talking about earlier. So that was happening. The buy-to-let changes came in just at the wrong time, arguably, for banks, ahead of what now looks like pressure on the residential property market, which, okay, it might be a very good thing for people buying houses, but in terms of what's good for banks, it might be a tricky few years now to be a retail bank focused on that market.
Indeed. And I think you make an interesting point about the challenger banks here, Emma, which is that they're not all created equal. So someone like Virgin Money has a very different business to someone like Shawbrook or Aldermore.
Yeah. So Virgin Money is a big focus for them is growing their credit cards business. And they actually already preparing for a low interest rate environment. So I would say a Virgin Money obviously is very different to a Shawbrook and an Aldermore, which is much more geared into, you know, the residential property market or the buy-to-let market, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and what do we make of the more Asian-focused lenders, Standard Chartered, HSBC? I mean, obviously, as we said, they had a couple of difficult years. Things are looking a bit brighter for them?
Well, yeah, actually, it's interesting. Linked to that, the more Asia-focused, we've just seen an update from Ashmore today, which was, it seemed that, you know, they were outperforming, and it seemed like maybe we're starting to see the turn of emerging markets. I mean, undoubtedly, it's a kind of a pendulum that will keep swinging. But I think HSBC, actually, it's got a good dividend that's well covered. So I would say kind of I upgraded HSBC to a hold, I think, for that reason. I mean, yeah, it is an almost impossible question to answer. You know, which is better, universal banking, retail banking?
I've got to say, when I look at that list of banks, the one that jumps out to me as the one that I would have in my portfolio is HSBC.
Yeah.
The reason being that it has that UK exposure, which you know, we liked elements of in some of the other banks, but it does have a much more diversified business model and feels like a much more stable business than some of the others.
There's a question at the moment around Asia, and they're putting a lot of stress on how they can grow in Asia.
Their Asia pivot.
But I buy the Asia pivot.
I buy it, but it's how quickly that change in the kind of Chinese economy, especially towards more kind of consumer-focused consumption, financial services and banking and insurance, how quickly that can happen. And they're putting a lot of stress on that. So, but yeah, I think if you look at this table, you're getting some huge discounts to forward book values in the current share price. So for you to look at that, you'd have to say, well, these are going to have to come down quite substantially, these their book values, you know. So I just, there's lots there for people at the moment. And HSBC has a very high dividend, but can it sustain its growth? That's the big question. Mm. And where is it going to find it?
I guess banks remain one for the long term.
Price to book valuations have come down a lot. So I think that's another reason that I would say don't completely retrench. I think it's just about picking out, you know, better capitalized, more quality plays, and it's for the long term, basically.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you very much, Emma. Banks after Brexit. Definitely worth a read. Lots more in there to get your teeth into. Okay. Just talk you through what else we've got in the magazine. Quiet week on the results front, but a busy week on the feature front. John Rosier, our private investor diarist, has updated on his experience of the Brexit sell-off. As well as that, we have a feature from Philip Ryland on a portfolio we launched in 1966. We've been around a long time, the Investors Chronicle, which has delivered a return of 4,492% in capital gains alone over 50 years. Just goes to show, stick with things for the long term and they will come good. And obviously, the next instalment of our 50 Objects series. Plenty in the news section beyond what we've discussed. And obviously, more comment this week, a lot of which is again focused on Brexit and the fallout of that. Chris Dillow, in fact, talking about liquidity risk, specifically in relation to the property story that we discussed earlier. And I've updated the COPOC indicators, which are becoming increasingly hard to read, but nevertheless still tell a story. And our readers are very keen on COPOC, our long-term buying system. So thank you very much for listening again. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Ian. And thank you, Bradley. We will be back again next week. Hopefully, we won't have too much of a torrid time this week. Thank you for listening and see you soon.